Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Moss Radio on mossradio.com, and my name is DJ Croak. I'm here with
Kai.
Hello. And yeah, we are your local community radio online, prioritizing and practicing engagement with each other, listeners, participants, and communities. And we do stream at select hours, changing every week, and you can find our programming and exact hours on the schedule page of our website, again on mossradio.com, which you're probably listening to right now. This is a pre-recorded broadcast, should be airing for y'all like Friday, 12 p.m. It is currently Monday, 3:38 p.m. And yeah, feel free to chat on the website or DM us on mossradio.nyc on Instagram, and you're listening to Drop In Harm Reduction Chats with Kai.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I'll let you kind of ramble on for a bit about, yeah, just an introduction, how you're related to harm reduction, but also just, you know, general stuff about you.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm relatively new to harm reduction, and that I only became really involved with it like 2 years ago. But it was one of those things where, like, as soon as I knew that it existed, I was like, okay, this is like, finally everything kind of makes sense. There is like a way to
practice. Some background on me is that I am a social worker. My specialty, I guess you could say, is like clinical social work, with a focus on addiction harm reduction and also gender and sexuality affirming care. Is kind of like two things that seem somewhat on the surface as unrelated, but I think are very, very much related, especially because harm reduction, is particularly important in communities that are experiencing a lot of intersectional oppression and compounding stressors and systemic barriers. So I'm trying not to like get completely sidetracked like every 2 seconds, because everything I'm talking about, I'm like, oh, okay, I could go into a tangent on that. So now I see what you meant by ramble. I graduated from social work school in, last year, 2024, in May. And I had a big interest in working in addiction in some way, but I just also found that it was incredibly demoralizing field to work in because of the fact that I feel like the role of social workers is often just to be a bureaucrat, mm-hmm. and to deny people or be the arbiter of whether or not people deserve services or should get the care they need, which is just something I really did not agree with or want to be a part of. And it was through learning about harm reduction networks, institutions that incorporate harm reduction into their practices, that I was like, okay, this is something that I can roll with, because all I really wanted to do as a social worker or in the field of addiction is allow people to come to whatever it is that they're doing or struggling with or wanting to change or not wanting to change, on their own terms, and not be a judge of them, but rather someone who helps them facilitate a journey or a process that they're interested in, and feel like self-motivated to engage in. Because, that just feels like what is a very normal human reciprocal interaction. And I think I feel the same way with gender and sexuality affirming care as well. And I had been, like, part of my social work school education was doing a field practicum. And my field practicum was working at a therapy institute doing specifically gender and sexuality affirming care. So in, like, the past, yeah, I guess you could say now it's like two or so years that I've been doing that. Harm reduction, I feel like, has also been a big part of my mindset there as well, in that it's not really my job, or I don't find it to be my job to determine whether or not, like, someone deserves a letter to get a gender affirming surgery, or, you know, like any kind of thing that could happen in the realm of, like, wanting to take ownership of your own body, wanting to take autonomy with your own identity. I just feel like my job is to facilitate that, and to, you know, help you put into your own words, like, what that looks like for you, and, like, what I can endorse as, like, a mental health professional. So, yeah, I think in that sense also, like, harm reduction has just been a big part of my ethos in any sort of, like, clinical practice setting, of just, like, how can I use the privilege that I have from, like, having a license and having like, advanced degree to just get people through systems that otherwise would put a lot of barriers up for very, very arbitrary reasons, which are rooted in systemic oppression. Just being more of a tool that people can utilize rather than someone who's in charge or, like, in some sort of hierarchy with the people that I'm working with.
Thank you.
That was supposed to be my introduction, right? Okay.
Yeah.
My pronouns are them.
Yes, there you go. One of the questions that I had, like, sparking off of that, I guess it's, like, how, like, integrated was harm reduction into, like, social work education itself, you know, for you at least?
Not really at all. At least it was not part of, like, the curriculum of any of the classes that I took. Although I will say I did take a really good substance use class, which is really, I mean, it's not even really funny, but it's ironic that this class in the, like, official curriculum at my school was called alcoholism and substance abuse, which is, like, already, you know, that you're, like, yeah, in it for, like, not a harm reduction mindset, like, very, very stigmatizing language, and also just very erasing language for a lot of people who don't identify with that, or don't fall under that category, but, like, benefit from substance use treatment. And but I had a professor who did teach from a harm reduction lens. So all their materials were, like, substance use, but it, like, literally they wouldn't change the course name officially in the register. Yeah, so I think that pretty much sums up, like, that's a maybe symbolic of the larger issue, which is that, like, the institutions themselves, like, even if you have, like, some actors within it that are espousing a harm reduction mindset and are interested in teaching that, the institution will never reflect that language, and is very, I think, threatened by that language and harm reduction practices, because in a lot of ways it takes away this, like, unearned power and control that the institution of social work has. Is my take on that. So yeah, I didn't have anything officially taught to me, but I had a lot of professors who, you know, were just actual good clinicians and recognized that things needed to be done on the terms of the people they worked with and not on their own terms or on the terms of the NASW or, like, whatever the hell other, like, governing body there is for social workers. Yeah.
Well, something that's, like, wait, I, like, completely just lost my train of thought.
Happens all the time.
No, I was thinking about, like, yeah, like, people treating it as kind of this new, you know, this, like, new quirky part of substance use fields, instead of just, like, it's evidence-based practice.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I also had a similar experience with a curriculum being, like, super, yeah, like, from the 70s almost, really, in terms of, like, talking about, like, the language they were using and stuff like that. But, yeah, and then I wanted to talk about the peer group I've spoken about on Dispatch on this radio before, but if you want to do a little intro of it, since you are the guest.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I guess it all kind of started from my perspective when I got a show on 8-Ball Radio with my friend Lucas last year. And the idea of the show that we pitched was, it's called Needle Exchange and it's like harm reduction radio. So we were bringing on friends involved in music and nightlife to, you know, play music with us and then talk about their experiences with substances and with harm reduction. And I really wanted that show to be a place to like plug certain resources, like, you know, how to get involved volunteering at Alliance, which is like, was a big part of my like journey into harm reduction and somewhere I still work and love so much. And I'm sure we can talk about that later. But yeah, and like just generally having resources for people who are interested and are listening to get involved with harm reduction in some way or another. And yeah, I felt like there were not that many resources already that could be provided. And then DJ Croak, or DC for short, hit me up and was like, yo, do you know any harm reduction groups like in the city? And I was like, no, I don't. Like, I tried looking some up. I was like, I'm sure, you know, he's already tried this, but yeah. And then we were just like, should we start one? That's kind of how it happened from my perspective. And and then we did, and we're running it virtually for a bit. And I started just, you know, kind of like talking about it on the show. And then I think a big like pivotal shift for us was that we were able to bring it in person at 8-Ball Radio. The, you know, membership was really keen to have it in the space and stuff, and like it have been super supportive. And so I think once we started running it there, we just started getting more like regular attendance of people who like really were looking for that in-person space and community. And we started like being able to fellowship and stuff afterwards. And that's been super just like lovely. And yeah, I'm really excited to just see the group continue to grow. And just to have something that like, when so many times I've just been like, I don't have enough to offer, like, I want to be able to, like, let people know about, like, places where they can find community and acceptance and care, but those places just seem so few and far between. They just don't really seem like a focus, like, as far as I know, especially, like, yeah, I think harm reduction is like a big buzzword now, I feel like, in dance music and clubbing scenes. And a lot of times, like, I mean, first of all, clubs don't do nearly enough harm reduction work. But then on top of that, it's usually like, yeah, it's the clubs providing like test strips or like, you know, people who are overseeing and making sure that like spaces are safe. Yeah. But yeah, there just isn't actually a lot of like community-based harm reduction in these spaces. I feel like there aren't really a lot. Like, I end up, you know, when I'm out having so many conversations with people about substance use, about that are just like so harm reductive. I don't even know if you can use it that way. In nature. And it's just sad how kind of fragmented it is that we're kind of having these conversations. Like, so many people have so much to talk about when it comes to these topics. Yeah. They might not even know what harm reduction is, but then it's very siloed into these like little, you know, like small conversations. And there isn't really a sense of a greater community of people who are like, oh, we're all, you know, trying to look at this and address this in very, very different ways, coming from very, very different experiences. But we are all in community together with very similar goals for what we want for our community in terms of like safety and the well-being of everyone involved in these spaces. So it's kind of sad that there isn't more of a sense of those spaces existing to talk about harm reduction in a collective sense. And so that's like what I'm hoping that, you know, our meeting and like, you know, the other things that, you know, are coming up. We're not the only people doing like harm reduction work or creating workshops around harm reduction in the city. But that this will be the start of something a bit more substantial in terms of, yeah, community organizing around like harm reduction, especially in spaces where it's extremely relevant. Which dance music is only one of. There's plenty of others.
And I think this would be a good time also to say the name of our group. We're talking about the New York Harm Reduction Home Group, which is Fridays from 6 to 7 p.m. at 8 Ball. And you can find more information about it on nycharmreduction.org. But also, I was wondering if maybe we can read the principles.
Yes.
I can start off, or I can do it. So, we prioritize empathy and support when engaging with each other. Everyone has the right to determine their own path. Harm reduction includes abstinence, all paths to abstinence, and continued use. No path is inherently more valuable or better than another. Every relationship to use and risk is unique. We are the experts in our own lives, and we are in community with one another and take care of one another to the best of our abilities. So that's kind of the like framework that we're operating under, which honestly wasn't even like that difficult to come up with when we were, you know, planning this, in the sense of like, it felt very like obvious. And also there are a lot of like other resources for these types of meetings. And like, it's not a new project, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, like it definitely already exists. And I feel like it, where I felt like it was lacking was very like
in person, maybe.
Yeah, in person and in New York City. Because New York, I mean, I think it's also all relative, because New York is a huge city, and you know, if you want to have something that's accessible to people, you kind of need to have a lot of it.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, 12 step here is very successful, I think, in the sense that like there are just
so many
every day, so many. And so like, if you want community and you want a program, you know, centered around addiction, like you're probably like the most help that you can get right now is just from 12 step because of the availability of it.
Yeah.
It's just going to be there. But I think that's, you know, kind of a shame, because that's just one. I mean, I think it's wonderful that it exists.
Yeah.
in such like abundance, but also like I feel sad that other types of groups don't exist in the same abundance, because it's like very, very much needed. And there's just this huge gap, which Sheila Vicario writes about, like the harm reduction gap. It's like 90% of people who are dealing with things related to substance use or addiction are just completely like not in treatment or getting treatment of any kind. And so, you know, there are so many people who don't find, like maybe would find 12 step to be accessible in a physical sense, and that they go to it, but in a mental and emotional sense, it's not accessible for them. Even though they're still interested in talking about substance use and engaging with thinking about it for themselves and their community and their friends. And so that's, you know, where I think there's just a huge kind of dearth of resources available, and what I'm hoping will come up more and more and more as this kind of like framework is spread around more and is recognized by more people as something that's a possibility. That's a way to find community that centers around those things. But it is like, you know, it wasn't super easy, I would say, even just like, it wasn't super difficult, I'll say as well, but just in terms of getting this meeting off the ground, I think we had had to do a lot of like networking in certain ways, like had to have access to a certain amount of resources in terms of like even getting access to the 8-ball space, for instance. And so like, yeah, it's not super easy. And there's like a need for people who are willing to step up and like create these spaces. And it's going to be like kind of a lift at first, like as I'm sure it was for 12 step in the Bill W era. But I believe that it can, you know, the more that it becomes normative and people recognize it and like spaces recognize that it's something that's needed, that these kind of conversations and like starting these kinds of groups will be a lot easier. That's my hope.
Yeah. And also, I don't know, I feel like the goal is even to, if this develops enough slash when this develops enough, to be able to have, yeah, like multiple locations or multiple meetings and during the week, and also for people to be able to take the structure and do something with it themselves. But something also I've been thinking about is like this resistance that I've encountered in a lot of people when I'm like, oh, like you should pull up to the group and stuff like that. Where I think there's this like, oh, but I'm not there, you know, like I don't need it that bad yet, kind of, or like this, like I'm not, like I don't need that type of help and stuff. We're really like, because it's a harm reduction group, it's not asking you to do anything that you're not ready to do or that you don't want to, you know what I mean? Like there really are no expectations about like what stage people are at with substances, or if they're even there to talk about substances at all. It could be something completely different and behavioral. But it's interesting kind of the way that like people don't want to interact with that type of like help network. Or like a very, you know, there's like a certain like reputation behind it.
Yeah. Well, I kind of think of it in general as like, it's just a free therapy group, you know, yeah, like exactly. In general, it's like what is needed. If you look at like how many obstacles there are to getting therapy, another like issue in New York. Yeah. Like we really just need spaces to talk to people and like just be able to share our feelings without feeling judged. And I feel like people's resistance to it is like, you know, sometimes it can be because of the stigma of substances, absolutely. But I think some of it is also like the stigma of just getting mental health care in general. It's like, oh, there's not something wrong with me. I don't need therapy. I don't need this. And it's like, you know, therapy is not like a cure. It's not a medicine. It's like, it's a tool that is just like a part of mental health hygiene that anyone can benefit from if it's like, you know, done in a way that's not harmful. So yeah, I think it's indicative of just a larger kind of like belief that getting help, seeking help in community, seeking help for mental health in any form is weak or is indicative of a problem, when it really can just be indicative of like a effort to take care of yourself, like in a totally like reasonable manner. Yeah.
And something I think we've also tried to work on in the sense of like, how do we make this a space that acknowledges this, is like having the group be somewhere that speaks about also structural and systemic issues and their effect on our lives.
Yeah.
'Cause I think a lot of substance use treatment is really focused on like the substance itself, or you know, the individual patterns. But if you look at it more on a coping mechanism scale, then yeah, we've been trying to figure out, you know, like how do we encourage people to also like recognize how we live every single day, and the systems we live in are impacting the way we use substances as well.
And that's something that like I think you are uniquely positioned to get from a group setting, because like even in therapy, you know, like I've spent plenty of therapy session like ranting about systemic like prejudices and like systems that, you know, are built to like foster inequality and dehumanization, and like you know, that is one thing to be heard by a therapist, but it's not like the therapist, I mean, and I'm not saying that therapists can't agree with you in these things, but it's very different to like be in that dynamic, as opposed to like being in a community setting where you're like, oh, I hear you, and I had this experience, and like put together the pieces of like, oh, you're expanding the way I'm thinking about how these systems are impacting us through like our shared experiences and different perspectives with coming from different identities and different like just general life experiences. And I think that's like really can be really beautiful and like transformative of just like being able to like collectively be like, yeah, fuck this shit. It feels a lot stronger than just saying it on your own, from a singular perspective. So yeah, I really think that's like kind of a really key part of it. And I think something that harm reduction is like harm reduction groups are uniquely positioned to do in a way that I also feel like 12 step doesn't really do. And because the 12 step also is kind of built around, it's super community based, but it's also built around a very like individual model, like of like, this is like these are your defects, like as an individual, this is like your journey or burden as an individual. And like, we'll all work together to go on these individual journeys. But I think I, you know, want to offer something, an alternative to that, where it's like, it's really like everything that we're doing is impacting and impacted by each other. And yeah, we have to, you know, like that a main part of like understanding the things that we struggle with is the ways in which the world around us has disabled us or has, you know, made it difficult for us to like live in accordance with our values, and look at it more from a top-down perspective.
Yeah. And I feel like something that's also been really nice about the group is like the variety of experiences in there, since we're talking about, you know, the different perspectives and stuff. And I feel like a lot of people will expect a certain type of drug use or a certain type of behavioral like addiction. But there's really just been like so many different like avenues and ways for people to come to this group, or through which to come to this group. And it's also been nice, I think, you know, for example, we've like talked about like even seeing psychedelics or something like you can get addicted to, which is something that, like, so many people say you can't, or like weed or things like that, you know, like really having a space where like everything can be treated as what it is. And if that's something that's negatively impacting your life, then like, let's talk about that no matter what.
Yeah. Not making any like assumptions about what, which I feel like is also like a problem so much in like, you know, for me doing social work and addiction, like right now I'm rotating through like NYC Health and Hospitals, and it's like the medical model of addiction is like so specific about what is or isn't addictive, and like, you know, like what qualifies as like high risk behavior, what qualifies as, you know, cause for concern and like need for short-term therapy, et cetera. And I just don't agree with that. I think that anything can be extremely addictive or completely harmless, like depending on the person who's doing it and the ways in which they're engaging with it, and even like the way that engagement was set up in the first place in their life, and like what role that thing, whether it be a behavior or a substance, is playing in their life, and most importantly that they are not fucking with it, like that they feel like it is harmful to them or not helpful. And it really can vary from person to person what actually they find to be harmful, as opposed to like what the medical system would say, oh no, your problem is alcoholism. Like, I've talked to so many people who are like, yeah, I drink like this many times a day, which is like, you know, hits the like criteria for like AUD. But like the thing that they're actually struggling with and they want help with and they want someone to focus on is like social media addiction, or is a, you know, a abusive relationship that they're dealing with, which also, like, if you start to see like how all of these things are in and of themselves related to addiction, like for especially with like intimate partner violence, like why people return to those relationships, like what kind of addictive mechanisms are set up in that dynamic of like seeking comfort from something that ultimately is hurting you, but it's very hard to get away from. Similarly with like certain types of like obsessive compulsive thinking, like there's very it's all the same kind of patterns of addiction, and also like very similar things going on neurochemically in your brain when you're dealing with anxiety or with certain emotions that you don't really want to confront through any type of relationship, thinking pattern, behavioral process. So I think there's just a lot of work that needs to be done to educate people about behavioral addiction or how addiction can manifest outside of substances. And I think that that works kind of twofold in the sense of you can start to recognize like ways in which you engage in addictive behaviors that you might have otherwise been told can't be ever addicted or can't, that are like totally harmless, even though they are hurting you. For instance, we talked about, it's like people saying like LSD is not addictive. Like that's not true. You can absolutely have an addictive relationship with LSD. But also in the converse, that you might be able to recognize as well that what you judge as being separate from yourself, which I think a lot of people who don't feel like they have substance use issues are like, okay, well, that's not me. Or if some people who are struggling with certain substances, like we just talked about, like weed, are like, oh, I'm not on heroin. So that's like, I'm not dealing with any sort of addiction. I'm not that. It's just like, that's where I think a lot of the stigmatization like is concretized, is like this idea that there are like addicts and then there's like normal people. Right. Not the case. It's like normal people are addicts. All people are dealing with some form of addiction. I really don't feel like there is anyone who can say that they're completely like every relationship that they have with every single thing in their life is like totally healthy and doesn't ever like enter territories in which they're doing it and not, and you know, having negative effects. Because that seems kind of crazy to me, going back to like the systemic issues, to live in the world that we live in and not need to cope with that in some sort of way. And so we're all just trying to figure that out, whether it's with our phone, whether it's with our partners, whether it's with, you know, like watching Netflix. Like it's just like, and we're all just trying to manage that and do those things in as healthy a way of as possible, but it doesn't mean that it's just totally out of sight, out of mind. Like these are really helpful things to think about and process and talk about, and to recognize within yourself, and to also recognize how you relate to other people who are struggling with things that are different from the things you struggle with, but based in the same types of coping and like survival mechanisms.
Yeah. I guess I wanted to go back and kind of discuss the different options for substance use treatment in the city, if you know of them.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm like super like well versed, but just in my experience working in a couple different types of like healthcare settings, I would say the main things available are the classic kind of like inpatient, outpatient, or intensive outpatient in like the traditional substance use treatment model. And there's like a variety of different institutions offering these services, ranging from like hospitals to like nonprofit rehabs or like city or state funded rehabs, and then like private rehabs, which are like extremely expensive and like offer conceivably like a better set of services and more like personalized care. I think all of them are like, I don't want to speak to this too much because I don't know exactly. I'm just going to say more based on like personal experience, like not incredibly effective. Like I think there's a pretty high relapse rate for people who like go through these programs, and there's, you know, a variety of reasons for that. But I think part of the issue is that the traditional like addiction treatment options are not equipped to service the majority of people that need addiction care. There are a few people who like really, really are benefited by it and are able to take those resources and feel like they work for them, like make them work for them and kind of be like, this is it on my own terms, doing it in this model, like people who really respond to the structure of the programs, who really respond to like the medically assisted treatment options, people who, you know, find it helpful to have the accountability of like being drug tested all the time. But that's just not the case for the majority of people who are struggling with addiction. And also a lot of people don't go into these programs really from a sense of like self, like voluntary, like interest in the program, but rather because they're experiencing pressure from friends or family, or they've been mandated to go through the program. So it's kind of like when that's the general like clientele that you're dealing with, it's very, you know, it's adding a level of like intense, like control and supervision, I think just like further erodes the treatment process, because it really feels like, okay, it's even more not on your own terms. So that's like the traditional, that's what I see as like the traditional options available. Then there are also 12-step, which in a way is like some, you know, part of traditional treatment options, but it's, I think 12-step is very like shunned within the like medical treatment model. So it's kind of like interesting. It's like more traditional than like a harm reduction meeting or a harm reduction like program, but it's still like the black sheep of like the traditional resources available in a way. So that's your other option. And then there's harm reduction programs that exist in the city who generally are serving more like resource deprived communities. So people who are unhoused, people who are, you know, blocked for insurance reasons or for, you know, stigmatization reasons from utilizing traditional addiction treatment services, because also those services are extremely strict about how you engage with them. Like you, there's a whole thing in mental health treatment that you, that you're taught, you don't work with people who are high. Like you don't do therapy with people who are high. You don't have someone in an addiction program if they are, like even if they're trying to reduce their dose or anything like that, like no, they have to be completely detox, cold turkey, sober.
Yeah.
That makes it really hard to treat a majority of people who are struggling with addiction, because if it was like that easy, more people would probably do that. So these programs are for, you know, are trying to fill that gap, but there's not many of them. I would say like the ones I would shout out to that I really appreciate are On Point and Alliance, specifically Alliance Lower East Side, which is where I work on Fridays, and I love so much. But yeah, that's the kind of the other option. And the other thing is that there's just like almost no overlap between those groups of people who are getting like traditional treatment. And I mean, it's not true. Like there, we have participants from Alliance who do go to rehab or try to go through detox and things like that. But it's also like,
it's even more the other way around, I think.
Yeah.
Like there's no, yeah, or like few like traditional treatment places will like recommend a harm reduction place if their participant is not like quote unquote succeeding in that program.
Totally. And also it's just so much like rooted in like classism, because of the like the resource basis for like people entering into harm reduction programs. It's like a lot of people won't even engage with harm reduction because of their like classist perception of what's that type of substance use or that type of substance use program indicates about a person's like value or reputation. So it's definitely.
Yeah, which is really unfortunate, because I feel like, or like I know that like so many harm reduction spaces are so community based, and truly, I don't know, like the yeah, you're unified by something and by a certain type of lived experience. And obviously there's still identity factors in that, and, you know, not everybody that uses or that, like, is going through addiction is having the same process. But, like, yeah, I think it's not useless, but, like, harmful a bit to, like, separate people so distinctly, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. It's just, it just sets more false impressions of, like, separateness, when I actually think, like, of addiction as one of the greatest unifying factors, and is something that, like, I really appreciated. So, like, a little background about myself as well is, like, I have, like, a 12-step background in terms of, like, a lot of my loved ones being heavily invested in 12-step, and then also I am now, like, 4 years sober from gambling in the Gamblers Anonymous program, and I think my experiences in 12-step, like, really, like, you know, I have my own criticisms, but I think what I always found really beautiful about it was that it's just, like, you just meet so many different people, like, who have so many different experiences, and, like, you really do see that it's just, like, when you're at your bottom, or when you've been, like, debased by, you know, something that you've been engaging in that has been really harmful to you, and that has been, like, also used as something to exploit you, which is, like, the history of a lot of, like, you know, substances and like gambling as well, in the sense of, like, gambling is state sponsored, like, in a lot of ways, from, like, the lottery to scratch offs. Like, it's crazy to me still to see, like, ads in the subway being like, buy a lottery ticket. Like, it's just, that's crazy. It's crazy to me that we're funding, like, our state through exploiting, like, people who are, like, really, really have difficulty saying, like controlling their gambling habits, which, like, you know, no one really wants to be spending, like, all their disposable income on scratch-offs. Like, I mean, you might get some pleasure from it, and you might decide it's not something that you want to change. But at the end of the day, like, who's really benefiting from gamblers? It's casinos and the states that are, like, setting up these.
People getting the money.
Yeah. So that's, you know, but anyways, the point that I was trying to get at is just that, like, yeah, when you've been debased by these kinds of, like, this exploitation, you know, you're all suddenly on the same plane, despite the fact of, like, coming at, you know, having so many different experiences. Like, it's like none of, like, you're all just human in that moment of, like, okay, yeah, we're just human. We have been hurt. We've made mistakes. And we're here to, like, come together and talk about those experiences and, like, try to be better together for ourselves and for our loved ones. And, like, yeah, I do think that's, like, a really beautiful thing. About addiction is that it, like, it does remind us that, like, yeah, we're not gods. Like, we're not, and that's kind of the whole, where all the, like, Judeo-Christian stuff comes in 12-step, is, like, the whole point is, like, you're not God. Like, there's a higher power, like, but I think the point of the higher power is just to recognize that, like, we are all not God. Like, we are all human, we're all equal, and we're all just kind of struggling and trying to manage. And yeah, I think it's really important for us to see that and connect to that and recognize that all the time with everyone around us. And I think, you know, we live in a world, and, you know, speaking specifically to New York, where, like, part of the fabric of this city, in, you know, and it's extremely upsetting, is to deny that and disconnect from the shared humanity that you have with other people, because if you connect to that, then you actually have to deal with the pain of realizing that there are humans all around you who are suffering extremely, and that no one is doing anything about being yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's part of just a larger issue of, like, the fact, like, how much we're able to dehumanize people in just the day-to-day, to go about our business, literally, like, because this is all, you know, all about productivity and business. And that's why, you know, we don't care for people in the way that we need to as a society. I just think addiction is ultimately going to be a big part of, like, reckoning with that. Realizing that it's like, why you don't have any more right to be a human than anyone else that you're interacting with or seeing on a daily basis. You don't have any more right to, like, be comfortable and be happy than anyone else. And, like, the idea that that should be the case is just so fundamentally wrong, and unfair, and like, in and of itself dehumanizing and sad, and, like, so far removed from, like, what it means to be human and to be in community with other humans.
Yeah, and I guess, at least for me, that was a big part of, like, I don't know, there were a lot of directions that we could have gone through the realization of, like, oh, there are little groups. You know what I mean? We could have put more efforts into promoting some groups that already exist, rather than, like, making one. But at the end of the day, like, the reason that I was more leaning towards, like, peer-run stuff and kind of just doing it ourselves in ways, like, yeah, it's all about being in that form of community, and also in order to be able to do that, recognizing that people who are living this right now and who have experience with it are the ones that should be able to, like, you know, take up some of that space in substance use treatment or addiction treatment that is taken up by people who, like, have never had any experience with it, and who have a very different lens on it. And I think just this kind of notion of, like, yeah, like, we all have a lived experience that, in this group at least, or, like, in peer-run groups, that is, like, valuable. And also, like, we're all here to, yeah, like, the facilitator is not, there's not this, like, power dynamic as much, you know what I mean, of, like, traditional clinical providers versus, like, patients or participants.
Totally. I feel like I, like, refer to the group, or, like, first and foremost as, like, a member, when I'm, like, talking about it to other people, I think, like,
yeah, me too.
It's like, yeah, I feel like we are just really, like, two members of the group. Mm-hmm. And, like, we play some, like, administrative role in terms of just, like, reminding people about it and, like, trying to get the word out,
but, and, like, just, like, getting our resources, yeah, you know, like, being the ones using, or, like, collecting the resources.
Yeah. And, like, and the nice thing about that is that, like, at any point, like, if, you know, people are interested in stepping up and doing that, that those tasks are totally interchangeable. Like, there's nothing mm-hmm. special about us that, like, makes us able to do those things, mm-hmm. except for just having, like, a certain amount of, like capacity in to do it, and, like, motivation. But, yeah, I really think, like, I show up to the group, like, not as a facilitator, but just as someone who personally benefits from it very, very much. Yeah. Like, I find it so helpful for my own mental health. I find it really encouraging. Like, I would show up to this whether I was facilitating it or not. Like, if someone else had told me about this group, I would do it. Because it's, I feel like I get so much out of it. I learned so much, and it's so helpful to both connect with people and broaden my mindset and, like, open my eyes to, like, these totally different experiences that other people are having, and connect to those things, and also get feedback on things that I'm experiencing. Mm-hmm. And it's never in a sense of, like, oh, here's some advice. It's just like, oh, like, this is how I relate to what you're saying, and this has been my experience with it. And it's so, yeah, it just feels so supportive and caring, and I'm just, like, very grateful for the existence of the group.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also been, like, molded by, like, it's so molded by the people that are in it every single time.
Yeah.
When we talk about how we're interacting with each other, even, like, the room that we're in, you know, I think, yeah, it's just everybody learning from each other. And as you said, even, yeah, for me as well, like, there is, like, I don't have this, like, ownership of it in my mind where, like, I must be the one reading the principles, you know, or it feels very much like, yeah, we all pull up, we all know by now kind of what's happening, and especially like it would be a bit presumptuous to call like reading a piece of paper at the beginning like facilitation.
Which we also rarely do at
this point. Yeah, right.
Like, and then that's like the, I think what's so exciting is that we've gotten to a point where like we have enough regular people that like it's less about like having to reintroduce the idea of what we're doing and more about integrating whoever is new into that. And I think it's actually way more organic to do that through like the people who are there living out these principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because we have 10 minutes left, there's a few points that I wanted to hit. Which I guess I wanted to ask you a bit more because you do nightlife stuff about kind of nightlife harm reduction and substance use culture in the city, especially around nightlife spaces. If you want to kind of,
I just feel like it's bad. Like,
okay.
I'm really disappointed with, and I wouldn't say like, oh, it's worse compared to other places, because I'm not super impressed with how anywhere is doing harm reduction, though I'm sure there are places, like I've heard Montreal is really good in terms of like nightlife and harm reduction practices. But yeah, I think there's just such a lack of care for the people who are engaging in nightlife. And I mean this on the behalf of like the institutions of nightlife that people are like patronizing, being like these clubs. I really don't feel like they like truly care about the people who are going there or see them beyond like a, you know, certain like monetary value that they're bringing, and a potential liability that they're bringing. Like there isn't a sense of like
potential lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly. There isn't a sense of like, oh, like, you know, you're a person and you're a part of building this community here. Mm-hmm. Like every single person that shows up to a club. And so it's our responsibility to make that community feel safe and also do our job to integrate you in that, you know, if you're around. So like that, if whether that means educating you on like how to make the safe space or what not to do in that space, or, you know, making sure that you're like safe if you're experiencing some negative effects of substances, which I think a lot of clubs in the city are just like, okay, you're a liability, get the fuck out. Mm-hmm. And that's really scary and doesn't make it feel safe to go to these places. It especially doesn't make it feel safe to go to these places alone. And that's really sad too, because I feel like that's one of the most beautiful things about nightlife and nightlife community is the ability to show up somewhere and feel like you're in community with other people.
Yeah.
Even if you're not like with your friends, like in a corner, it's like you're, and everyone should potentially be someone that can be your friend, that we can all connect, that we can all, you know, like love and enjoy each other's presence. Especially like plenty of us who I think got involved with dance music or nightlife because, you know, we spent a lot of time alone or feeling ostracized and without community in, you know, whatever our own like background and situation was. So, yeah, I think it's just like, I feel like that's such a duty for any business or anything that's engaging with nightlife to like really understand like who are the people you're serving, right? Who are the people that are involved in this and like what is important to them, and what kind of spaces should you be creating for them. It just doesn't seem that complicated, and also because it's like actually safer for you and makes you less liable if you actually help people. But it's just like, yeah, it's like many things within capitalism is just so, so perverted by the fact that there's like this value of something that has nothing to do with like the actual material value.
I mean, even in harm reduction in nightlife itself, I've seen some places that will have like testing strips and stuff like that, but that you cannot, like, even like if it's like a harm reduction table, let's say, at an event, they'll give out testing strips at the table, but you're not allowed to like test your drugs there. Like in front of them, which is so funny to me, but obviously not funny at all, because then you're just not, like, you're not making, like, if somebody's doing it in front of you, they obviously want to make sure that it works, so, you know, you're just, like, taking away the opportunity, and then they might do it wrong, and also just, like, even that is, because the whole point of that is that that's a liability,
It feels like virtue signaling. It's like the least lift thing that you can do to be like, oh, we're doing harm reduction, but like not actually create it, make it feel like at all a safe space. Because a big part of harm reduction is also the immaterial, like destigmatization of it. Like if people still feel like they need to hide and do these things, like they're not going to feel safe to get help in a lot of situations, including a situation in which they've been drugged, like which is, I think, one of the biggest issues right now, like in the New York City club scene, is that people are out there getting roofied and, you know, pricked, and like lots of, you know, really, really scary things, like a lot of like violence being enacted in club scenes that's just completely unchecked, because it's not the actual priority of these institutions, and that they don't actually fully with their chest like believe in harm reduction,
which is also so funny to me, because it's like, be for fucking real, like who's going to an NYC club? Somebody who's taking drugs.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't have a business
right,
if you weren't for drugs. Like, let's be real. Which is why it's like test strips is like the fucking bare minimum.
Exactly.
And even then, like, I really feel like that it's the responsibility of clubs, like a model that I really appreciate that, you know, I've seen at clubs in like the UK and at raves and stuff is like, having actual drug testing machines, testing the things that come through, like for people, like they can give you their stuff, testing it for them so that you do it correctly. And then letting the entire venue know what stuff has what in it so that they don't OD or experience something that they don't want to experience. Like that's within the realm of possibility for people to be doing. But that's not really the priority. And I think no one really wants to like even start to try to navigate the like legal landscape of what that would look like, because it's just not a priority at all. And no one is demanding that they do that, because people are just showing up every once in a while. Someone in their community is getting hurt very badly. And then it's just like, it becomes kind of like, oh, like that's too bad. Sucks that that happened to them. But like, you know, like drug. And it's like, no, this is a systemic issue. And there needs to be like a little bit more accountability taken for the fact that this is happening on everyone's watch, and specifically on the watch of the people that are providing these spaces and also profiting immensely off of these spaces. And I'm also not trying to say that like New York nightclubs are making crazy profits, because I know it's like very like not really financially sustainable to like run most clubs at venues in New York. I appreciate people that are trying to do that, but at the same time, it's like, if you're doing that through creating a space that is like inherently not safe, I would rather you didn't.
Right.
And I think that there is a way to accomplish both.
Yeah. I mean, it's also just not that hard to get harm reduction supplies if you're already an existing entity, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, there are many groups around the city that would table at spaces if asked by those spaces. But yeah, I don't know. I think also just it's so much more money is going into, these kind of initiatives that are like half-assed harm reduction, where it's like, we'll hand out Narcan, but like you're not allowed to show the drugs, you know, or like, you're going to get in trouble afterwards, or we're going to call the cops right after. Stuff like that.
Yeah, it's just like, it's not harm reduction in ethos, it's harm reduction in material. Like, in like.
Right. Like, or like, it's just like, literally concretely harm reduction. Yeah. Not at all in a.
Like, mentality. The quality of the things is harm reduction, or like the quantity. And it's like, it has like, it's like a harm reduction skin on it, a mask, if you
like
will.
A banana.
Yeah, it's a banana, and you peel it open and it's just like maggots.
Yeah. Okay, this has been our time pretty much. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for talking about all of this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hope this has been a good discussion for you.
Yeah.
And yeah, everybody, you've been listening to Moss Radio on mossradio.com. And this has been Dropping Harm Reduction Chats. My name is DJ Croak, and you are?
I'm Kai. Nice.
And do you want to?
You can also, find me on Instagram, kyxm.fm. If you want to, you know, get involved in any of the things that we talked about, if you're interested in volunteering at Alliance, or want to come to our meeting, or want to tune into Needle Exchange, which is my and my friend's monthly harm reduction radio music and talk show. We'd love to have you, and also are really interested in more people who want to share about their experiences. So if you're interested in music and in harm reduction, and you want to maybe come on the show, shoot me a message. And yeah, thanks for listening.
Amazing. All right, bye y'all.
Bye.